All right, say that again.
Well, at the PDC I was at.
Who was teaching it?
It was Bill Mollison, Jeff Lawton. And
I've heard of those guys.
Yeah, it was Melbourne University there in Australia. They, during the strategies for an alternative nation section, Mollison's opinion that he expressed to the students there about consensus was that you should use it only to come to an agreement, not to use consensus as a group process. So it was very funny.
And you think it might be available out there on one of the big long video set, the DVD set?
I'm pretty certain, since I haven't watched it, I can't confirm 100%, that it is the currently available DVD set that features Jeff Lawton and Bill Mollison and teaching at Melbourne University there, and it would have been shot in 2007. So if anyone's seen that, they can confirm it for sure.
But if nothing else, you're a directorish person of PRI USA.
Correct.
So you're part of Jeff's group. So this is kind of the official word on consensus from Permaculture Central.
Well, more or less, yeah. I mean, Jeff didn't come out and say yes, and I agree with him, but I think that's more or less how Jeff operates, too, for sure. And you know, and knowing Bill, that he loves to come out with those sort of cantankerous kind of statements. And
it sounds very Bill-esque. Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. I have a bunch of notes from the PDC, or not the PDC, but from when Sepp's been here, and I kind of feel like I want to get them into a podcast before they are no longer fresh in our brains. You up for this?
Yeah, all right. You want to do this now?
Yeah. I want to do it right now, John.
Sure.
Okay. I'm just going to go through the list of what's left. This is leftovers. Sepp Holzer leftovers. And so one was, as he was talking about urban gardening, and I've never heard of this one before, that people were using telephone poles for their urban gardening. And it sounded like a lot of it was divining, but then I also think that one of the things that you could do is he's got this sausage. I don't know if you guys have seen his sausage. This is where he takes the...
Oh!
not that! No! He takes some landscape fabric, usually a felt, and then he rolls it up with a bunch of soil inside. And then he'll pin it up so it's vertical, and then he'll stab holes in it and plant things in it. And so it's... I saw one where he had it 15 feet tall.
Wow.
And it was kind of attached to the side of a tree. And so it's like, well, you can do that with a telephone pole. You know, just right. Attach it to the telephone pole, and then you can have all kinds of plants going up and down the telephone pole.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Well, I think that the point is that if you're in an urban environment, you don't exactly have a lot of, you know, soil and sun to work with, so you kind of, you know, make the best of it. And sometimes making the best of it is you've got no other option. Well, this is an option. It is different, and it does work. So, but that was just something I hadn't heard of before. All right. The next one I got, I don't know why I wrote this down, fruit trees from seed. It sounds like he does do a little bit of that. Now, I'm a powerful advocate of fruit trees from seed. And so at least I know that Sepp does it. Because a lot of the times we see him transplanting. And he's got a variety of different techniques for transplanting trees. And he talks a lot about grafting and whatnot. But at least we know he does a little bit of fruit trees from seed. Did you guys remember anything when he was talking about that?
I must have missed that part, maybe.
So I'm paying attention more than you guys?
Could be.
Okay. All right. Yes, indeed. I got the best stuff. All right.
Yeah, I might have been off nitrogenating a fruit tree or something like that.
you did steal the best seat in the whole room.
Oh, I know that. Well, see, 3 years ago, I kind of ended up doing the same thing, where I sat front and center. But see, now, so 3 years ago was a little different. I mean, basically, 3 years ago, he pretty much just talked to me, and then everybody else in the room was kind of allowed to eavesdrop. But this year, he's talking to everybody. He's like, I mean, he does seem to talk directly to me a lot, like when he's pointing at me when he was saying the devil. Hey, man, that's not cool. But he seems to do a little bit of that, but not nearly as much as 3 years ago.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, is it just me? I mean, is he pointing to me a lot when he's talking? You don't notice. You don't think about it. All right.
Here and there.
All right. Yeah. All right. All right. The other one was that he did talk about, this must be an early note, he talked about hugel culture that's 3 to 5 meters tall. And when he says hugel culture, he includes stuff that does not have wood in it, whereas when we say hugel culture, we're always talking about stuff that has wood in it, buried wood. But he does a lot with berms. And then also, if his hugel culture does not have wood in it, he will come up with other ways to introduce organic matter. Dominantly, planting potatoes and sunchoke seems to be a big way that he'll turn just plain dirt into hugel culture. We went outside and for a while we got a little bit of a demonstration when he's talking about how he wants a high bed, which seemed to be a poor translation for a berm, and later the translator started using the word berm instead of high bed. And so he was talking about stuff that was typically 15 feet tall or something to break to stop the wind. I was going to say break the wind. but it was something where it's like you get all this wind coming through, and the idea is to get the wind to not be so desiccating, to dry things out so much and make things too cold. And so he felt like the thing to do is to put in quite a few of these berms around, which would then be planted. And when he does his berm designs, and he loves these berm designs, where they will be like 5 to 6 feet wide at the top. Then there'll be like a straight drop of about 6 feet or so, 6 or 7 feet. And then another platform that's like 5 or 6 feet again, and then straight down again. He likes this design that's kind of a squarish design like that. He believes that he triples his growing space this way. So like whereas the
ziggurat.
Like a what?
A ziggurat, those classic sort of ancient buildings that are like a pyramid except they're stepped.
Right, right. Very stepped, but with like these massive 6 or 7 foot steps.
Zep step.
Zep step. Maybe that's what you should call it, the zep step. Step step. Say it 5 times fast. You got something, John?
Yeah, he did say that one of the goals was to be able to get a piece of machinery all the way around so you could easily access things or be able to drive on top of them. He even said a few times.
The berms?
Yes. Yeah, he was saying you should be able to drive on top of them.
Drive what?
Whatever you need to drive.
Well, then it would have to be much wider because, like, if it's only 6 feet wide, I mean, maybe you could drive a motorcycle. Maybe the idea is to make them even wider, because I would think you would need it to be at least 10 feet wide in order to drive a vehicle or a car on it.
Well, he was talking about Siberia and building his crater gardens and being able to drive around the top because there's no snow on the top. The snow gets blown off the ridge there.
Huh. See, it doesn't seem like the designs facilitate getting up there. The designs that he's drawn or that I've seen, yeah.
I haven't seen any pictures of these absurdly large berms.
He had those in that one picture book, and it's at his daughter's place. He's got these with the Crater Garden. They're kind of the same thing, because the Crater Gardens are kind of like, they've got these steps inside of the SEP steps. I'll try to use it more now. SEP steps. But it didn't look like, it looked like something you could walk on, but I didn't even seem big enough, because like once those things start to fill out with bushes and stuff, you wouldn't even be able to get a wheelbarrow up there. Yeah, okay, all right.
Let's get him in here. He can answer this.
He had described it in several different ways, because he had described it with the 6 foot width, and then there was the other times he had mentioned driving on it. So it really depends on which time he was talking about. The one specifically in Siberia, he wanted to have them wider, is what it sounds like.
Well, I know that he's talked about them where you drive on them, but it would be like a dam. And like I know, like when he was talking about one of his ideas for a 7-acre pond, then he was talking about the dam would have steps, but then the top of the dam would then be like 20 feet wide,
right.
And then there would be a step. But then he didn't say. And then with a dam, you usually want a 3-to-1 slope on it. So then you could make something that's like 20 feet wide and then like 7 or 8 feet tall and 20 feet wide. So then it seems like that would be wide enough that you could drive on it. But the stuff where he's like building a berm, I mean, if you're going to build your berm so that they're wide enough to be able to drive on, now you're talking about a lot more work than something that's wide enough to walk on.
I think it all depends on use. If you're just building it to break or to stop the wind, then
detour the wind.
So that's how he was drawing it at one point. And then he was mentioning this area here was like 6 to 10 feet.
Yeah, your drawing doesn't go well on the podcast.
Gives you an idea of what he was talking about, though.
True, but if that, okay, so you've got a flat part there that's 6 to 10 feet.
Yeah.
But I think most of your, most vehicle-y things require 8 feet of width.
I wouldn't imagine.
Minimum, and if you've got stuff growing on the sides, then suddenly it's like those growies kind of, you know, stick out a couple of feet. So now you've lost some of that.
It seemed to be his idea was that it was equipment that you could use for harvesting purposes, because you're going to be going around that berm to pull pieces up. You don't want to haul it off by hand, all of it. It's going to be a long berm.
Okay. Well, let's leave it up for now to say that it depends. And I would imagine that a person could choose. Like they're going to have something that's 5 or 6 feet wide, which ends up being enough for a person to walk along. And you could choose something that's going to be maybe more like 10 or 12 feet wide, which is going to give you enough space to get a truck up there or something. And then if you're going to get a truck up there, then you need a way to get the truck up there. And a lot of the designs I've seen, there wasn't like something rampy or something to get the truck up there. But yeah, you could do something. But I guess, you know, each party kind of picks their own thing, because it's like once you're going to make it that wide, that's a lot more material you have to move around too.
That's why you have the crater garden.
Yeah, that's that big hole that we got the material. Hey, we're going to call that a feature. We didn't just make the Berkeley pit here. No, it's a feature. All right. Next thing I've got marked off, my next note says, it's a quote from the mighty, the glorious, the amazing Sepulcher. This is not about growing some vegetables and raising some animals. This is about healing land on a large scale. I just thought that was kind of nice. Oh, I've got a note here that says that he's created 200 projects worldwide. All right. I'm not sure if it's 200 that he's done or 200 that are currently active, like he's currently working on.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's active, like yeah. 200 that are still in progress that he's still involved with.
Because he said he said in some cases he's going to go back to some of these later on. So that's why I said it's probably active more than anything else, because some are probably done, some are still in operation at this point.
But when's he really going to kick it into gear?
Yeah, come on, man. Come on, pick up the pace. The world's big. So, another thing I heard is that something about the Tamara project. Apparently, there's like, he put in those lakes there, and then he went back to go see how things are going, and they were fucking with the lake. They were fucking with the dam. They did something, and he was pissed. And he's like, what you have done has endangered everybody that's downhill. And so apparently he got them to sign something that says, I will no longer have anything to do with this project, and that you can't be using my name for the project. It's like, I'm out of here. And he's really upset and angry. But that's just a rumor. Maybe when the dam goes kaput, then kaput being a popular word we've heard the last few days, he'll have his paperwork handy to say, "One me! Told you so!"
And maybe it's a good example. I have no idea what happened there, but I do know that something in permaculture, I think, needs to remember oftentimes in designs I see and focus on more is the social end of the design. You can't forget about the social part of any design. So you can have the greatest dam building techniques, the greatest Google culture bed construction techniques, but that once Zepp walks away or any other designer, what's going to happen? You know, how will that be maintained over time? Well, is that going to be continue to be kept up and administered in a way that's managing the land well? And that's a social end of the design there.
True. I mean, I know that, like, with this piece of land, Sepp is like, if he could do everything he wants to do, 35 people could earn their living from this piece of land. But now, I don't recall Sepp ever saying anything about, like, and here's how they're all going to keep from stabbing each other. Now, I think what you're saying, Owen, is that you're sensing this lack also.
I haven't heard him talk a lot about the social end of design, and from my experience and from things I've seen, if you don't have that dialed in, doesn't matter how great your other techniques are, because it won't last.
True. It does seem like wherever Sepp is in charge, and so then the social network is everybody does what Sepp says. If you've got like a great visionary, that like actually kind of works out okay. You know, you trust the guy and stuff. Although I know that dialogue isn't really his strong suit. Projection is his thing, and I think that we've kind of created Sepp to be that way from parading 20,000 people by him and saying inappropriate things. Now Sepp isn't so interested in dialogue anymore, it does seem like for the whole time he's been here, it's been pretty clear. We've all got along, and I think a lot of that is we're all going to do whatever Sepp says, pretty much, and we're certainly not going to try and piss off the Austrian.
Or the
Steppocracy. So I imagine that if we're on his land, that it's pretty much, everybody does whatever it is that takes to please Sepp. And if you're talking about another piece of land where Sepp comes in, does his thing, goes away, and there's 20 people now living on the land, now what?
And Sepp won't be here forever. And once Sepp goes away,
he won't. What are you saying? What are you trying to say?
Saying he's a human being like the rest of us, and sustainability requires more than a single lifetime.
Well, I'm kind of thinking for a moment like it's granted here on this property, Katarina is in charge, very clear. So what's the social network going to be? I mean, there's probably going to be 7 or 8 people that are going to be here after this event is over, and they're going to continue working. And then a month or two from now, it'll be Katarina and Michael and maybe 1 or 2 other people still here. As much as Sepp wants 25, 30 people, it seems like just a collection of a very small number of people. So now you're showing concern, you're expressing concern about what's the social network going to be like. And so do you, for this particular property, do you sense trouble in the future?
No, I'm not saying I sense trouble, but I sense it's an issue they will have to grapple with or the project will fail. That's all I'm saying.
All right. No, I think that if you're going to say, let's have 25, 30 people be here on this land, and keeping in mind that Katarina travels probably 5 months out of the year, it does kind of seem like something needs to be set up. And then it's like, how are these people going to get along and move forward and enjoy their time here? Because, a lot of times drama comes up. And so how do you dodge the drama and thus leave behind happy, something like that? But now, so you're thinking of social network stuff. Do you have like a quick thing that you think would be the kind of thing that should be, when it comes to social networks, I guess it's never quick. But do you have like an idea of something that you would like to see in place here that Sepp is to fill this void?
Well, I mean, a basic process that I use, because since being also a holistic management certified educator, that's a framework that does have something like that, in the sense of the group of folks who are making decisions on the land, who, you know, have influence on what's happening here, you know, come to the table and, you know, share a dialogue, essentially, about, you know, what they want their quality of life to be like far out into the future, and what they have to produce in order to achieve that quality of life, and then what the land has to look like far into the future to support them producing those things that will support that quality of life. That's basically a holistic goal. So, you know, but it doesn't have to be that process. But, and I think folks here will understand this and will ultimately deal with this. But basically, some type of goal setting process, and then maybe subsequent to that, of course, a goal is constantly evolving as well. But subsequent to that, a process for you know, making decisions together, even if there's one person who's clearly in charge, like Katerina or whatever, including other minds in the process is only going to be more valuable to her and to the land. It's a, you know, diversity. Two heads are better than one, then 10 heads are better than two, and so on. So something like that.
I want to say it depends on the heads. Yeah. But so I kind of feel like on this property, and probably many of the properties that Seth visits, there's usually somebody who's in charge, and then, you know, how the social network, I mean, how it falls out from there is going to be dependent upon that individual. Each person who owns the property and is in charge will have a different way that they like to do things. You know, the Bullock brothers, I always think, is an excellent example. Three brothers are effectively in charge, so between the three of them, they must have some kind of system, maybe even consensus among the three, and then everybody else who's there is like, you know, they also do a consensus-based information sharing thing a lot of the time, but if there's ever any kind of conflict, well, there pretty much can't be conflict, because then it's like, you know, one of the Bullock brothers can say, you know what, we've thought about it, and this is the way we're doing it, and then everybody else, no one gets weepy, they just say, okay, I guess that's the way we're doing it, and then you move on, whereas in a consensus-based system, it's kind of like, you know, either you don't move forward or somebody gets weepy, and it's hard and difficult and frustrating.
Time consuming.
Have we got this one? Have we covered it? We're good?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Next item I've got on my list is Holzer favors solar and wind over microhydro. I was a little surprised by that, because it seems like in the videos that are 12 years old, it seems like, oh, we power the whole farm off of this one little microhydro generator. And but now, as we're seeing him design stuff, he's kind of like, no, solar, wind power, yeah, that's the way to go. Microhydro, And so he specifically said at one point that he favors solar and wind over microhydro. Not quite sure what's up with that. Kind of would maybe like to flesh that one out a bit more. Did I miss anything? John's got something.
I've never seen in any of his videos any solar panels, and for any of the projects he's been on, or even at the Kramerhof, I don't know if anyone else has seen them, but I was very surprised to hear that.
Well, one thing he did mention, and perhaps that's the 12-year gap thing, is that in the last decade or so, the technology has advanced so much that it makes it, perhaps that's what sort of caused a shift for him, is that it makes it much simpler than it used to be, or much, maybe the cost has come down enough and it's reliable enough now that he feels more comfortable going that way, that's actually in the end more reliable, sun and wind, than the microhydro systems.
You know, my feeling has always been the opposite. Microhydro, if you can do microhydro, if you have the opportunity to do microhydro, then that is vastly superior to wind or solar. And you only use wind and solar when you don't have microhydro available. It's just more reliable, more consistent, better return on investment, you know, those kinds of things. It just seems like the big winner overall. And so I'm kind of curious, like, if it ain't, why? Now, the podcast that I recorded with him, he talked about it a little bit, and it sounds like, you know, they're going to take that river and they're going to rip out 8 kilometers of river. They're going to bottle it up in a pipe. And so there's no river. There's just a pipe sitting there. And that's okay. The law says that that's totally cool. In fact, we're keen on that. That's awesome. That is so cool. And then at the same time, if you've got some guy like Sepp Holzer who's got a creek on his land and he wants to, like, you know, lay a pipe in at the top and take 5% of the water to run microhydro, fuck no. You're going to destroy habitat. Just think of the fishes and the wildlife. And so... and some people are leaving. Bye.
Bye from Detroit.
Oh, and Detroit says bye.
Bye,
his coat says fat farm, when fat is spelled P-H. So, all right, so I kind of think that the microhydro is the best. Oh, right, I was saying something about how one strike against microhydro is that it can be, even if you have water on your land that you can tap into and use, it's like illegal. I kind of wonder about the idea, I've seen a few people doing microhydro where basically they have, they've kind of created a little catamaran-like boat-looking thing, and a paddle wheel sits behind the two floaties. And then as the river pushes the paddle wheel along, that generates a little bit of electricity. Yeah, well, it's not very much electricity, and at the same time, not a big environmental impact there. And you could do a larger one, and you could also do a couple, perhaps in series. And so, low environmental impact, I think.
If I remember correctly, they're called run of the river systems or run of river. There's an actual name for them, and there's a few different kinds that I've seen. They actually have one that looks just like a little electric motor, like a trolling motor head, with a propeller on it that you stick onto the water and it spins. But you get much, much less power out of them because it's not focused, and you have to have a large volume of water to make them work.
Yeah, you're talking tens of watts at most instead of hundreds or kilowatts. You're just talking very small amount of power or something like that because you just don't have that much pressure coming from the river. Unlike the high head pressure that you get from microhydro generally. So you get some advantages with the relatively low impact, but you just get very little power comparatively.
Right. Very little power. The awesome thing about microhydro is that it's 24/7.
Right.
And it's very reliable, and so then, you know, you just need enough to be able to provide enough power for your needs. But the key, the point I'm trying to make is that no, against the law, no. But if a millionaire wants to take an entire river and put it in a pipe, oh, that's okay, because it just kind of has this whole stink of somebody got paid off.
Well, part of it depends on how you're affecting the property that you're on, because water rights are a very big issue in the West, obviously. If you are affecting the flow of water, then you're going to have a problem in the future. If you're not affecting the flow of water generally, you're not going to have much problems. It's only when you're having these affection of flows that changes somebody's water rights issue, then you got a problem.
Well, and, I mean, there's water rights is one issue. Another one is wildlife habitat kind of stuff, you know. And it's like, and I remember one time... my neighbor called on me that, you know, I'd built ponds, and so I got reported. And so the Department of Making You Sad gave me a call, and they wanted to talk about it. When I explained my pond design to the guy on the phone from the Department of Making You Sad, he kind of forgot about the fact that he's supposed to be making me sad, and he's like, really? Tell me, how did you do that? And then what happened? And then, so then he's like taking notes, and he's like, oh, I got to see this. This is excellent. And it's kind of like, but then I just moved away. All my problems, you know.
Well, and that's a good case, though. That's a good example right there. He probably looked at your example and goes, hey, there's nothing actually occurring here. It's any problem for anybody except for your nosy neighbor. And not only because you're upsetting the neighbor. Who cares? That's not a government issue.
Right. The neighbor can't even see it.
Yeah.
But But the point I'm trying to make is the guy from the Department of Making You Sad called up, and basically his thing was, is like, okay, you know what? Building a dam, that's okay. So you got a pond, that's okay. You know, doing this and doing that, these are all okay. What's not okay is receiving any benefit whatsoever. Does it look pretty? If it looks pretty and is easy on the eye and makes you think, ooh, a pond, that's receiving benefit. Therefore, it's against the law. If you keep trout in it, that's receiving a benefit. That's against the law. If you use it for any kind of irrigation or holding water capacity or to like plant a tree there that otherwise wouldn't be able to be there, and you want to take in the beauty of the tree, like a willow, that's against the law. Receiving benefit is against the law. Doing it, apparently, if you just do it on a lark and will never look at it and never receive any benefit, that's okay.
This goes back to that question of who are you talking to? Because if you talk to certain areas of government, they're perfectly fine with one thing.
Oh, yeah.
If you talk to a different area, they're going to be completely against it. And they always contradict each other completely.
Absolutely. Right. And we've talked about that many times before on the podcast. Yeah. And so you're right. It's a complicated maze, and you need to know your way through the maze before you even begin, or else you're not going to get very far. So, have we beat this one enough? I can't remember what the topic was we were talking about.
Started out with wind power and solar and kind of morphed.
This could be the reason why SEP is like, you know, not a big fan of micro hydro anymore, because there's just too much chance that it's going to make you sad.
I understand the solar. Solar's pretty dead simple for most people, but wind, I still don't get why you go for wind over hydropower. Wind is a maintenance nightmare for most people.
Have you ever been to Great Falls?
Yes, I have. There's any place across the eastern part of the Rockies, you got heavy duty winds coming down the way, and nothing really holds up over time. It just comes apart after a while. And if you ever seen any of these equipment after 10 years, you can see what the kind of abuse they've taken. They really get the hell beat out of them.
Okay, all right, that's a good point. I suppose that you could like mend them and stuff, get more life out of them. But that's something, actually, that's a point I hadn't really considered. The lifespan might be short because they just get rattled to little pieces.
As long as it's nice and consistent, as long as the wind's nice and consistent and maintenance is done well, it's not a problem. But that's because you have pro guys up there maintaining it on quarterly, yearly basis all the time. They're actually working on these things. The guy at home, he's not maintaining these things very often, and that's why you see a lot of them get locked up or turned off or otherwise just shut down, because sometimes even taken down because there's no maintenance being done on them.
Right. It's just got to be a pain in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's a good point. That's a good point. All right. Next item I've got is he's talking about visitor paths. And so when you make a visitor path, and I noticed that this particular tidbit is not true with what we've recently built. And here come a bunch of people. Are they done doing stuff outside?
Yeah.
Oh, so now we're going to go back to this other. We're going to hear from Sep again. Oh, he's going to talk some more.
No, he's not.
Oh, it's lunchtime now.
He said, Avírase.
Oh, like he's done for the whole trip.
Yeah.
Oh, well, bye. See ya. Okay. No dead ends in the visitor path is what Sep writes about. And in his book, Sep Holter's Permaculture, he has a great example of that, where it kind of meanders but yet still loops back. However, here in his design, he's got like a little kind of spiral, like just a single, maybe a loop and a half of spiral, where if you walk down this path, it suddenly ends. So that is a dead end. Just a quick little note.
It's not finished.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It's not finished. Maybe it will go up or something.
Or it's the exception that proves the rule.
Oh, yeah, that way it's like, there you go, walk down that. Now, how did that make you feel? It sucked, didn't it? See, don't do that.
Did he actually say these were visitor paths, or are these just people that work your paths?
visitor pass. He was very, and so basically the idea.
The ones here.
Oh, the ones here. Maybe it's so that you can introduce stupid people into the system, and then they're easy to find. They're all piled up at the end of the dead end. What do I do now? You know, and then it's like, and then or maybe that's why there's that extra loop in it. That way, the stupid people all end up down there, and they're kind of out of the way. You know, it's a little easier now. Yeah, something like that. I don't know. Maybe I'm not sure. Another point he had was so this is a quote: "Don't do things for the money. Do things for life." And it does. I mean, it does seem like it's one of those. You know, we say this here. The cliche here is, "Do what you love, and the money will follow." I think that's kind of what he's saying. He's just he's said it over and over again that he's on vacation 365 days a year, traveling the world and doing what he loves. You know, saving the planet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Follow your heart.
Sep validates my Great Falls podcast. So in my Great Falls podcast, I said, because they had all that wind, I said, build some big berms, some 15-foot tall berms. And the only thing I did not say in my Great Falls podcast was this whole thing that he does where he puts a big path about halfway up. And so that way you've got a place to walk to be able to get up to the stuff that's higher up. And but Sep is a very big fan of like lots and lots of berms in places where it's windy. Animals cannot self-medicate with dried or picked medicinal plants. Only plants that are still growing. I thought this was a really important one because, of course, one of the things that Sep advocates is that, you know, plant lots of poisonous plants, which is always the example I turn to for, like, some people think that advanced stuff sounds crazy. So you say, oh, plant lots of poisonous plants, things that are poisonous to your animals. You need lots of poisonous plants. And then and then you hear about the reason why, and it doesn't sound so crazy. That is that this is the animal's medicine cabinet. And but apparently, the animals do not know how to self-medicate if you have picked it for them or if it is now dried. So it has to be fresh.
He kind of made the point that you don't put it in their feed. That was the one thing, because they know how much they want. You're not
right.
Supposed to supply it for them unless you're as instinctual as the animal itself.
Right. You don't. We do not know. We are being, and a lot of his point is that a lot of people that are practicing, like they're giving animals shots for worms or something like that, it is an act of arrogance to say that we know more than the animal does about what it needs. And so they need to be able to make their own choices about their own medicines. That's how they're programmed to do it. You'll notice that deer seem to get on the fine in the wild without worm medications or, other medications or without a veterinarian. Amazing, isn't it?
Absolutely. That just speaks to the value of really high diversity in your pastures if you're talking about livestock animals or, but of course in your gardens too, it's the permaculture principle everywhere. But, having that plant diversity allows those animals to do that self-medication year-round. And so that means you've got warm season plants that are giving you diversity as well as cool season plants that are giving you diversity. So something's green and growing all year round that they can actively self-medicate with. But if it's not there, they can't do it. Also, if it's not there, they can't pass it on to their young because, these animals have culture too, and they, the young ones learn what to eat from their parents. Essentially, they say, oh, what are you eating over there? And maybe I should try some. So sometimes if they haven't had that sort of cultural training, if you will, they don't actually know to eat those things.
That seemed to be a recurring theme in a lot of stuff that Sep talked about whenever there was animals, was that how the parent will teach the child of whatever type of animal we're talking about, and a variety of things, a lot of things. And so as opposed to like you go out and you get day-old chicks or something like that, like that's not appropriate. What you need to do is have chicks that are raised by a hen that knows a thing or two. The same could be said for cattle and all the animals, pigs.
You did mention the dumb pigs a few times that don't know how to root.
Yes. Yes. So we heard these stories quite a bit. It was a good theme. I think a very important message.
Those are the pigs that make good bacon.
the pigs that don't know how to root?
Right, because you get them out of the gene pool.
You know, oh, those are, okay, I get it now, all right. Oh, here's a great one that he mentioned like two or three times, on the respectful harvest of animals. He did something once. There's a group of people there which included vegans and vegetarians, and then he does a respectful harvest. I don't know what animal it was, but he does a respectful harvest, and then they prepare the food, and they make it available, and all the vegans and vegetarians ate the meat. And apparently they were no longer vegans and vegetarians as long as the meat was harvested respectfully. And he did talk about respectful harvest a little bit. And usually a lot of it, and but of course it also got him going on to an hour-long rant about, you know, CAFOs and less than respectful harvest systems and how they work and how bad they are. And he was just kind of getting more explodey every minute. And somehow we derailed that.
that story really reminded me a lot also, and I don't know if Sepp's heard this story, but of a story Bill Mollison told, which I think is also on that DVD we talked about at the start, because it would have been from the same PDC. But apparently Bill Mollison was having a PDC a long time ago, and there were a large contingent of vegan vegetarians there, and they had a sheep there as part of the class, and he decided they were going to eat this for the final meal. And at some point, the vegans and vegetarians had kidnapped this thing and taken it away. And I don't remember all the details, but the bottom line that reminded me of the Sepp story was that they did end up making some meat, and then and he said the vegans and vegetarians just pretty much didn't leave any for him. They, and so the quote there that Bill said that was just funny is like, you've never seen anybody wolf down meat like a vegetarian.
Oh, that's a good one. I like that. You guys have anything else to add on that one? No? Okay. I have some questions here that it looks like my notes say I didn't get around to asking. Oh, here's one I did ask, and the answer was weird, and I'm not sure. So I said, how do your philosophies differ from Fukuoka? You guys remember when I asked that?
Yeah.
And so then he was pissed off about somebody in Greece filling planes up with seed balls and dumping them. It didn't work. He thought it was stupid, and he kind of said, your stuff sucks. This is shit.
He said that whole episode was just a political stunt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but he did say that, and like in this 5-second thing, but Fukuoka stuff is great. Next question. And it's like, really, that's it? You know, don't want to admire any particular aspects or anything. That was it. So it's like, it seems like he didn't bash Fukuoka. He just bashed these dipshits that didn't seem to quite get it.
He said explicitly, Fukuoka's methods are exemplary.
Apparently that was his exact words. I haven't heard him say anything else about Fukuoka. I thought there might be a lot more detail there. I mean, it does seem like a lot of their stuff is very similar. And so you'd think that there might be like these little differences or something like that, or these certain parts where Sepp would say, you know, I heard about Fukuoka doing this thing and it was awesome, so now I do it and it's awesome. But nope. That was it. All right, so... I wanted to ask the question, have you ever experienced mudslides with your terraces? I never got around to asking that. Maybe I'll be able to track them down. Kind of seems unlikely.
He talked about way back at the beginning, the first one he ever built, he wondered why it went down the hill, and then he figured it out, and it doesn't sound like he's had much problem since.
Right. I didn't know if you build a terrace and it's made of clay, like the soil is clay, and you don't have it... You need to have it sloped away, you know, like downhill. You need to have a little bit of downhill slope to it. Otherwise, if you have an uphill slope to the terrace, now I know I'm saying it wrong, but if it like traps, if you build the terrace in such a way that the water runs off the terrace, runs downhill, it'll be fine. But if you build it so that it traps water on the terrace, it'll fill with water and go downhill.
Depending on the type of soil.
It depends on the type of soil.
And
but You know, do you have any more details about that, just as his early terrorists?
Well, that, he said he ran in crying to his mother. So I'm assuming this was very early.
Oh, right. Yeah, let's assume that, yeah. I can't see him as an adult running home to his mom crying, you know. So I can see his mom crying from something he's done as an adult, but yeah. Next question that I did not ask. Actually, he answered it. Holzer permaculture versus permaculture. And so he talked about that a little bit. And it kind of seems like he's called himself a hippie in the past, but now he keeps saying something about, I actually hear him use the word hippies when he's speaking German. I hear the word, and then later it comes the translation which has hippies in it. And so it's like he believes that there's some hippies that, like, he looks at their examples of permaculture and he kind of thinks, like, yeah, I don't like it. I don't care for it. He's got all kinds of words to say that he doesn't like it. He's not seeing a lot of good examples. It's rare to see a good example of what he thinks is good permaculture.
Some of it seems to be the issue of scale. That's one of the biggest issues he has with a lot of the conventional permaculture, is that the scale's too small. He looks at the larger scale. If we want to save the world, we have to do this on a large scale. We can't do this with the small scale systems. He had mentioned at some point, I know, that he was just disappointed with the small scale.
Well, it seems like he does urban stuff. He'll talk about urban stuff. He'll even talk about doing permaculture on a balcony. But it does seem like what he likes to do is the big stuff.
Well, yeah, because so many of the conventional permaculturists were against his use of mechanized equipment in a lot of cases. And it frustrated him because he couldn't seem to understand that if you want to change things, you have to have these equipment to use that line about if you want to change things in days or years, you depend on what you use, I guess, what equipment you use. If you do it by hand, it's going to take you a lifetime. If you do it with equipment, you can do it in days.
Well, that's true. You know, especially if, like, here this big problem was created with big machinery, and you know, I'm not going to be able to undo it with a shovel. You're right. So, but as far as Holzer permaculture versus permaculture, I know that he feels like he gets some grief from some people because he uses big machinery, and then it seems like a lot of the examples that he's using, or a lot of the examples he's seen, don't quite meet his criteria. Meet his standards, at the same time, he feels like he started down the permaculture road because the permaculture people, the people that made up the word, asked him to call it permaculture. So, fair enough. The next question I never got answered was, how many people live on the Kremderhof year-round or seasonally? I think it's just his family. From what I've heard, it's just him and his wife, his son, and his son's family. And it sounds like they're not really actively farming it so much anymore. It's mostly just doing tours.
And they have the one employee, additionally, the neighbor.
Oh, right. They talk about a neighbor that's been working for them for a very long time.
He moves the animals.
Yeah, he moves the animals. Right.
Yep, but then there's some interns as well, but they're not paid unpaid interns. Like,
but that's still people, though. We do count interns as people.
So said in some of that documentation that he now has 10 houses in sort of his eco village.
He has. I've heard Emo mention that he has huts. And I don't quite understand what that means. I would be nice to see pictures.
Side of the hill with the timbers on the side.
Starts off as an animal habitat, and then it looks like, you know, intern will do fine there. Yeah, put the interns in there. Yeah, they'll stay warm enough.
Like a blanket for the door, and you're good.
They'll stay warm enough that you don't have to feed them as much. Interns. Another question that I never asked was, is he familiar with Lawton's food forests? And you know, what you know, how he feels like his food forest might be different. But we never got to that. Next point I've got on here. So this is an interesting one. Apparently, his son Joseph is now the owner of the Kremderhof. So they've kind of divided Sepp's empire, and Joseph is in charge of the Kremderhof. He's the farmer on the Kremderhof. off, and Sepp signed it all over to him, and now Sepp just puts his focus dominantly on his more global empire. Raspberry plants, cut off the top, cut top off when planting because too many leaves and too few roots. Oh, okay. So if you're going to transplant a raspberry, then you cut the top off when you transplant it. And it's because once you've transplanted it, you need the raspberry plant to put energy into the roots, not into the leaves. And yet it's programmed to put it into the leaves at that time, which will then make it die. It won't get its roots established. That was an interesting point. Next one. Oh, the root plucking tool. He has this tool. He kind of has this gesture for to talk about how he goes up and down the hugelkultur beds, and he kind of does this. He kind of mimes this thing where he's holding a pole, and on the end of the pole is a sharp thing, and he twists, and it cuts roots of things he doesn't like. And he calls it the Falken flat cutter. I thought the name was good, so I wrote that down. But he mentioned that about 8 times or so.
And he does have a picture in his new book that's in German.
Oh, the one that's the paradise. What is it? Desert or paradise? Yeah.
It kind of looks like an open looped hoe.
It's yes, like pod people, look at this image. Here, I'll wave the microphone over the image.
So that's the description there. Yeah. It looks like an open hole, a hoe that's used for cutting stuff. But you just cut the tine off, basically, and make it a hook instead of a hoe. I forget what those are called. You know what I'm talking about? The clothes.
I kind of think of it as like a tiny comma, like there's a short blade on it, like a short comma blade on it, and then you just kind of stick it into the roots and give it a twist and cut the roots.
Basically
just a little bit.
Sheet metal curved into a hook.
Yeah,
flat metal blade with a bend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a Russian design, so that's why it looks like it does.
All right. Plants grow much better in symbiosis. I mean, that's pretty standard permaculture stuff, but I like the way he says it that way. It's a different way of saying guilds. Here's a good one. With hugelkultur, I get vegetables 365 days per year at the Kramerhof. I think that's, I mean, I imagine it's from microclimate, so there's got to be a few sun traps and that kind of thing. I just like the idea because, like, a lot of people want to put in a greenhouse. And I just kind of think, rather than doing a greenhouse, which then you're like, you've bottled something up away from nature, and so now you're going to have all these fungal problems and bug problems, and you've got to take control of that. So rather than doing that, and on top of that, that glass filters out some types of light, you know, and that can't be good. So rather than doing that, instead, just set up a whole bunch of sun traps outside, and then you don't need a greenhouse, and you can still grow greens all year. It just seems better to me, and I wish it was more prevalent. All right, another thing is that he wishes to make it known. He wishes to be clear. He currently has 72 ponds. Not 70, not 80. He has 72. It's 72, and it was 72 3 years ago, but you'd think that there'd be more by now. But apparently no, there's 72. Everybody write that down, 72. I think that might be the answer to life, the universe, and everything, but I could be wrong. No, it's not 42. Yeah. I was thinking maybe Big Think came up with the wrong number. Maybe it's supposed to be 72. Yeah.
I'll go obscure for 1,000, Alex.
Yeah. We did seed mixes here one day. So we're going to go plant the hugelkultur beds with a variety of seed mixes. And he came up with probably 5 different seed mixes to go out there. So it's like, okay, time to plant all the hugelkultur beds. 5 different seed mixes. One thing that was important to him is that when you mix seeds, you have to not mix big seeds with small seeds. Everything has to be about the same. All the seeds in a seed mix have to be about the same size. And then when it's tiny seeds, then you mix it in with like sand or something like that. So that way it doesn't get too concentrated. And then he also gave weird demonstrations of how to fling and how not to fling.
It's a very dance-like flow to the whole thing.
Yeah, he did. He had like a little bit of a fling dance kind of going on. It was very important. Dance this way, you know, the horizontal dance. Do not do the vertical dance. He was like very, I don't know, did people try to do, maybe this is like, people think the natural way to fling seed is overhand. And he's got a very horizontal fling. I don't know. I guess we've seen him do it often enough. I just think, why would you do it any other way? But maybe some people, it's in their nature to do it that way. Melons and squash mix for the base of the hugelkultur beds. So melons and squash want a little bit more water, and the seed is bigger, and really they belong at the base of the hugelkultur beds, and because the top part of the beds tend to be a little bit drier. So one of the mixes was focused on like the bottom part of the beds, and another mix was for the top part. You want to, this came up. Some people were like, hey, well, you know, here we are in Montana. The average last frost date is like June 3rd or so. And here we are early May. And we're planting a lot of stuff that's frost sensitive. Is, you know, that can't possibly be okay. And he's like, nope. It's totally cool. Put the seeds out there. There's going to be a little bit of mulch. It's going to go into the mulch. It'll be fine. It'll be safe. This is a great time to plant this stuff.
I think you said the plants are smarter than that to come out before.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of truth in it. I mean, think about it. With volunteers, then the volunteers are going to wait until it's warm enough and then get going. And then even then, not all of them will germinate. So then if it turns out that they think it's warm enough and it's not, then there's a second wave coming for the next warm spot. So it'll all work out. Water pipes of plastic can be okay. So he's got this statement, which I'm looking around trying to find where I wrote it down, where it is critically important that the water be in contact with the earth. That's the natural way. And the idea of having cement or liners is not acceptable. However, having water pipes of plastic can be okay. Water pipes of metal is not okay, but water pipes of plastic can be okay. It's got to be a good kind of a food safe kind of plastic, I suppose.
Specifically said food safe plastic. And the issue with metals is generally for cost. It's just too much. You said copper was okay, but it cost way too much. That was the big issue with that.
Right. So then when he's using pipes, he's using plastic. And he is the master, so I guess, all right then, you know.
He talked about that specifically, using the blue versus the orange and whatnot. He was basically describing text in great detail, though.
That is the end of my notes.
I know.
Do you guys have anything?
Nope. Barbecue's up.
Yeah, are we all exhausted? I know I'm wiped out. A month, all day, without a day off. There was actually a day off, but then I ended up working on that day to help get problem solved.
The day off wasn't actually a day off.
Yeah, we all had to work in order to make the event work out. And then I had a day off where I was sick, but I was sick because I hadn't had a day off. So I don't think that counts. And then I was sick, and I kept coming in here anyway, even though I was sick.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Yes, and I shared my diseases with everybody. But it doesn't seem like anybody got sick after me.
No. It all worked out.
But yeah, I'm ready to go home and take a week off and rest. I'm pooped. Although actually, tomorrow morning, I know we're getting up. We're going to go look at property tomorrow morning.
some people wanted to get some feedback. They've been asking me for 2 years to come look at this piece of property, and now we're close enough that it's like, okay, fine, on the way home. Any notes from the party last night or from any of the things?
Nothing we should go public with.
Yeah, I believe the line, what happens in Montana stays in Montana with Houston.
Yeah, yeah. And that's just marketing. Yeah. I reveal all. I saw some things. So, all right, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com. And I mean it. You better come out to the forums and post something, damn it, where we talk about the mighty, the glorious, the amazing Sepulcher, homesteading and permaculture all the time.